So welcome everyone. The idea tonight is to introduce the work that the Lodge is going to do throughout the year. And although what I'm going to talk about is a little from the book that the members are going to study in their study group or meetings, the intro to theosophy is actually on the same subject. It is using another theosophical author that is less technical. It is more appropriate for an introduction. Dr. Taimni is more uses Sanskrit words, and it's a little more technical, so it's not so conducive for general meetings. But both subjects are the same, are self-transformation. And I think it's important before dealing with the subjects to have a certain understanding of the perspective, how these subjects are approached. For example, if we see in Buddhism, when the Buddha speaks about the spiritual path, he says the first step is one of right view. Sometimes it's translated as right belief, but I would say we have to start with the right perspective. Krishnamurti would say the first step is the last step, in the sense that the first step we take will set the direction. So if we want to go north, but we start going east, we can walk all we want and we will never get north. So it is important before we start walking to know that we are going in the right direction. So in this world, I think this world, our current culture is enamored, in love with technology. And this also penetrates the spiritual worldview. It seems like spirituality is a collection of techniques. We develop like a spiritual technology. Do this, do that, these are the techniques. You don't need to change your life in any way. Just breathe in this way. Visualize this. Chant this. Just follow a technique and you will attain whatever you want. From the theosophical point of view, that is not quite right. Techniques applied without the proper worldview are not going to produce deep results. Because the main problem we have, like Shankaracharya, for example, who was a Hindu sage, he started one of the schools of Hinduism, Vedanta. He said the problem in humanity is one of ignorance. We not intellectual ignorance, we don't perceive correctly who we are or what life is about. We are living in a confused way. Therefore, he said, no action per se is going to solve the problem of ignorance. The only thing that will solve the problem of ignorance is wisdom or knowledge. Knowledge not in the conceptual way, knowledge in the sense of right understanding. So no matter how many actions you do, no matter how much you practice or you do religious rites, he would say, even if you perform karma is a Sanskrit word that means action, for thousands of cycles, with that only, you will never attain liberation. Because the main problem is a problem of lack of wisdom. So the only thing that will bring liberation is a correct perception, correct understanding. Then techniques may help you in that endeavor, but only if what you are seeking is to understand correctly. If you are using the techniques with the wrong point of view, from the wrong point of view, it's not going to produce any result. And I will explain why. So when we see today in spirituality or in any of the fields, when we see books on self-help or self-improvement, What normally do we mean by that? Normally, self-improvement is how to make, I don't know, myself more skillful in some aspect, physically or mentally or emotionally, developing emotional intelligence, or trying to be happier, to be more joyful, to have more pleasure. In general, all the approaches to self-improvement and self-help are based on the idea, this is what we are, my thoughts, my emotions, my body. And what is most important is what I do in these short years that I am within this body. Because after death, I don't know what happens, we don't care, we don't look at that. So from that point of view, that this is what is important, the answers about, you know, what should we improve, what should we do, the answers have to do with the little interest of this little personality in this little time in the existence of the soul. And therefore, the effects will be superficial. They will be just confined to that little thing. And I'm saying little because from the theosophical point of view, we are far more than this. From the theosophical point of view, existence is far more than the little experiences we go through life. A life that is spent very happy with everything we want can be a life wasted from the point of view of the soul. Actually, you know, in the story of the Buddha, if you see, there was this prediction that the Buddha could become a great king or a great liberator of humanity. So the father, who in the story wanted to kill the spiritual thirst and grow and impulse, what did the father do? He gave the Buddha everything that he could want. All the pleasure, all the possessions, all the happiness. Because that is how we kill spirituality. As Plato said, great countries, great cultures, great civilizations begin to degenerate when they are too comfortable. So if we look at self-help, self-improvement, self-transformation from that point of view, we will probably just kill anything that is deeper. Krishnamurti would say, we talk so much about content. We need discontent, but a creative discontent. We need to not put ourselves to sleep. We need to wake up. What happens with a baby? A baby wakes up when there is some kind of pain or discomfort or some disturbance, and he wakes up and cries. And then that need is attended, he is fed, and then the pleasure puts him back to sleep. Because pleasure and pain are both important in life, but they are important when they are both together there. Because what wakes us up is the difficulty, the challenge, pain, philosophically speaking. And then pleasure is for us to rest, for us to take a respite, to heal from the effort. So pleasure is important, but pleasure is the point where we are not really growing. It's when we are recuperating so that we can keep growing once we gather our force again. It's like if we want to climb a mountain, we are actually advancing when we are making the effort and we are climbing and our muscles burn, and at some point we have to rest, and that is perfectly fine. It's healthy to do. But when we are resting, we are not climbing. So I'm putting this in this way because in our culture, it seems like the aim of life is pleasure, is to be happy, is to be joyful. Of course, all that is important, but not in the way that we normally approach it, because we approach it in a very narrow way, without seeing a wider picture of why we are here, what is the purpose of life, what is the purpose of difficulties. When pleasure becomes the You know, for example, you see even in psychology, there is this idea that for a person to be healthy, that person has to grow in a harmonious environment with, you know, nothing that can that may challenge the child, because any negative experience produces a hurt. But actually what you see is that children that grow in that kind of environment, with in environments where there is all the money, where there is influence, where they are quite, you know, not healthy children. Actually, healthy children are the ones that had more or less a balance of both things, a lack and also a source of protection and of giving a little but not all, having limitations, not too much, not too little. So life needs both things. If we overstate or value too much one of the sides, if we value too much suffering, then again, we are in a problem. Some Christian mystics would go to the other extreme, not only Christian, in other traditions too. And that is also a problem. But in our culture in general, we don't have that problem of paying too much attention, you know, giving too much value to suffering. So I'm placing more emphasis on the pleasure question. So when we look at just this personality, my thoughts, emotions, and body, and just this lifetime, it seems obvious that I don't know why I'm here. All I want to do is to just have a good time. Now, when we look at this whole thing from a higher perspective, then we may reinterpret life in a completely different way. And also, what are we supposed to do? Because meditation may become another form of seeking pleasure, seeking to feel well, which is not going to help us in any way to deal with life, which life will bring us challenges. Or meditation can be a way to transcend my attachment and my bondage to the things that I like or dislike. But what the effect of meditation is depends on how we are meditating. We may be doing exactly the same thing, but if I do it because I feel so good, and I want to feel good, and I cling to feeling good, then my meditation finishes, and I have a difficulty, and then I run back to my room to feel good again. It's just escaping from life, seeking pleasure. That is not going to produce any spiritual result. Or I may do the same meditation with the intention that this meditation, if it is a correct meditation, you know, I'm not thinking about any technique in particular, I'm talking in general. If it is a correct meditation, this meditation will allow me to realize my true nature, the true nature of life. And because that is what I'm seeking, how I feel in meditation is secondary. Samdong Rinpoche, who was the right hand of the Dalai Lama for a long time in Tibet, or in the government of Tibet in India, and he's a member of the Theosophical Society, a member of the Krishnamurti Foundation, he would say, if you are seeking in meditation to feel good, just take a pill. Meditation is too hard just to feel good. Take a pill, if that is what you are seeking. Meditation is something far deeper, can bring far more things, but if you are not interested in that, you know, do something else. Watch nature, listen to music, all that is perfectly fine. And you can feel good. But the purpose of meditation or the purpose of the spiritual life is not that. So what is the perspective that the Theosophical tradition, and I would say any serious tradition, proposes? But I will focus on how the Theosophical tradition presents it. Well, first that this body, these emotions, and this mind are just temporary expressions of what I really am. Like, for example, I go to a play and I have to play a character. I enact that character. I express certain emotions, certain thoughts, certain actions. Now, I am far more than that character. In my life, I'm far more than that. I have played many other different characters in the past, and I will play different characters in the future. But for that time, this is my role. So from the point of view of the soul, this personality is just a temporary role. This personality of each one of us, we come here and we are given a particular character. Because as psychology knows, our personality is formed in the early years of our lives before we have any say on how to respond to the environment. Isn't that unfair that I will have to deal with the world with a personality that was built as a response to what happened in the environment at a time that I had no way to choose how to respond? I wasn't aware. I didn't have any other option. And yet, what happens in my early years is what will set how I start my life in this personality. In the theosophical view, what happens in the first years, the personality that is generated, is a result of previous actions of the soul. But we don't need to go there. My point here is that when I wake up to the world, when I begin to be aware of myself, I have a character that was given to me for whatever reason, past lives, it doesn't matter in what from the point of view I'm looking. I didn't choose in this life to have this kind of mind, this kind of emotions, this physical body, maybe healthy and unhealthy, emotions may be stable or unstable, the mind may be bright or maybe dull. I didn't choose. I woke up in this particular character. Now, the problem is that we assume the limitations of the character, and this is what Shankaracharya was talking about. Our main problem is we don't know we are in a play. We think we are the character. Life compels us to play this character, and it's like if I'm in a play and then all of a sudden I forget myself. And then I start assuming that I am the character with all its flaws and its possibilities. And playing or looking at life from the point of view of the character, without knowing that I am far more than that, generates a lot of problems. So the idea is that it's very important to discover who we really are. For example, many of our problems are not our problems, are problems of our bodies. Of course, we need the body to manifest on the physical plane. But, you know, many of the problems, look at your life and see whose problems are these. And you will see that many of them are problems of the body. The body likes this weather or not. Do you think that you as pure consciousness like some weather or the other weather? Pure consciousness is not material. It could care less about the weather. But this body likes this weather or not that weather, or this food or not that food. Do you think that consciousness aches when waking up in the morning, or consciousness gets sick? No, this is all the body. Of course, I use the body to manifest, so what happens to the body is a limitation to what I am, but still, this is something that is happening to my body, not to myself. Similarly with the emotions. We think we are the emotions. Well, you know, this is an example that I give frequently. You know, after lunch, we feel we have the desire to eat something sweet. This is my desire, right? This is me. I want to eat something sweet. I enjoy it. It's the pleasure of life. Now, in many occasions, in many cases, the desire is induced by a parasite that is in our guts that feeds off the sugar and generates the neurotransmitters that give that signal to the brain. So the worm is saying, hey, I want something sweet. And we say, hey, I want something sweet. You know, parasites in lower animals and in insects, for example, they can drive, they go to the, you know, to an insect and they can make the insect do things that are self-destructive. Well, that is not only with insects. We do things that are self-destructive because we have parasites. Maybe not physical, it may be emotional parasites. You know, I'm using a metaphor. Or mental parasites. Why do we think the way we do? Did we choose our views of life? Or did we absorb them from family, environment, past experiences? So the problem we have is that as long as I think and my thoughts, emotions, and body, and as long as I think that the aim of life is to get this to be happy, all my life will go around, you know, pacifying these things that I call thoughts, emotions, and body. But maybe I came for something far more transcendental than pacifying this personality. Maybe I came because it is through this personality that I can discover, become aware of my divine nature. In the theosophical view, we are spiritual entities. And as spiritual entities, on our own plane, at home, you know, on non-material planes, we are eternal. We don't need anything. The problem is that we are not quite aware of our own nature. On those planes, the unity is so pervasive that we are aware of the whole, but we are not aware of us being a part of the whole. So the way that nature has to make us aware is first, like taking us out of the wholeness and becoming to be aware, or starting to be aware of this separate part. You know, it is like the case of the babies. Babies are not yet aware that they are individuals, and according to psychology, they live in a state of unity from a certain point of view. They don't realize, I have my own body, I have my own individuality, but they are not really aware of that unity. An enlightened being feels that unity, but is clearly, consciously aware of the unity there. There is a difference. One is an unconscious unity, and another is a conscious unity. So our souls are dragged into this character because by experiencing life in a separate form, the soul begins to recognize, I am a center of consciousness. Now, at the beginning, the soul, you know, Plato would say when the soul incarnates, it goes through a river and it forgets its true nature. So when we wake up within the body, we say, I am this body, and I forget who I really am. And this is in a lot of traditions. I think in the Kabbalah, they say before the soul incarnates, an angel shows the soul, you know, its true nature and what will happen during the play that the soul is going to enact during physical life. But then the angel, you know, puts the finger on the mouth so to forget. And then when the soul comes, the soul forgets everything. And if you see in many traditions, there is this idea that outside of the body, we know who we are. To some extent, you know, because at the beginning of evolution, as I was saying, we are not really conscious, but at least we have a sense of being the oneness. And when we come into the body, we forget this. In the process, so the purpose of life, we are sent to a prison, let's say. And there is a purpose for us to be in that prison. The purpose is for us to learn how to escape that prison. But what we do is that we are born in the prison and we say, oh, this is my world. Well, let me start decorating this so that we make it more comfortable. So we put nice paintings, a carpet, and, you know, we improve the place. And we still live in a very small, you know, building. But we are very happy. Self-improvement, self-development is just painting the walls of it with a better paint. And that's more or less what we do when we think that we come here just to be happy. You know, there is unfortunately, I think, you know, in modern times, the way that Buddhism came to the West is heavily emphasizing, like, happiness is the aim of life. And of course, happiness is, you know, if we think of the true happiness, what is happiness? Happiness is not pleasure. People who have everything they want, they are still unhappy. They may kill themselves because they don't find a purpose in life, even though they have everything. of course not everybody, but there are many people who have everything and they still are not happy. They go to extremes of drug or sex or whatever it is, because having pleasure has very little to do with happiness. So Aristotle, for example, the Greek philosopher, said that happiness is more a sense of fulfillment, of this is worth doing, it is worth, you know, living, it is worth not of being happy in the sense of being excited or having pleasure. It's the sense of purpose. So we come to the world and we think, Buddhism comes and say, happiness is the aim, you know, we may all be happy, we be happy. I think we should understand what happiness really means, and I think we misunderstand it. There is a Buddhist book published a few years ago. The title is Not for Happiness. That the spirit and this monk was emphasizing, no, the spiritual life is not for happiness as we understand happiness. Of course, it's not for the opposite of happiness. The spiritual life is to realize our true nature. And we will find that as we do that, there is still pleasure and pain. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, this Hindu scripture, when the enlightened being, the yogi, the jnani, is defined, it's not one that never ever again feels pain. That's not the definition. That's, I would say, that the current idea that spirituality is one in which there is only an extended, continuous, unending pleasure is an expression of our materialistic culture, what Chogyam Trungpa would call spiritual materialism. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said a yogi is a person that is beyond pleasure and pain, for whom pleasure and pain are irrelevant. Because sometimes life brings pleasure, sometimes life brings pain, but there is a state of awareness, of consciousness. There is a realization that puts us far beyond that, in the sense that, sure, my body doesn't feel good right now, so what? It's not a big deal. I realize it. Or my emotions are restless now, so what? Or my thoughts are going in that direction. It's just, you know, it's raining outside, so what? It is raining. The thoughts are, you know, going in that. It's just the psychological weather, emotional weather. There is a state of consciousness where we are free, not free in the sense that we don't feel this, but in the sense that it is just an accident, it's irrelevant. We are in a far more stable state in which these things, sure, they are not really important. And this happens to us, you know, when we are doing anything that is worth doing, many times we act in this way. You know, you have a baby, the baby cries in the middle of the night, and you wake up, and sure, you would stay, you know, prefer to stay sleeping, but that is irrelevant. You wake up and you deal with the baby. Of course, that doesn't happen every time, but there are moments in which you can see many times in life something brings some kind of inconvenience, but you feel this is so important that the inconvenience is irrelevant. So there is a state of consciousness where, you know, this may happen more and more. Now, this is what the spiritual practice, at least from the theosophical point of view, and I would say from any serious tradition, this is what the spiritual practice seeks. Not to produce happiness or pleasure, not to produce pain either, not to eliminate either of those, but to discover that from which pain and pleasure can be accepted, and they are not so important. Now, to be able to do this, then we need to understand our true nature, and this is part of what the study with both books is going to be about, you know, to examine our physical nature, our emotional, mental, our spiritual nature, and having a correct understanding of who we are, we can look at the purpose of life. So we tend to think that people who are who we don't like, they are a nuisance. Why are they here? I don't want to relate to this person. Because how are we judging life in that, from that point of view? Well, life should be so that I feel good. But if we understand that life is for something far more important, is can I be free from the slavery of my pleasant or unpleasant sensations? Can I go through life doing what my intelligence, spiritual intelligence, says is the right thing, regardless of whether that brings transitory pleasure or pain? So when I have to relate to this person that I don't like, is this a way that life is training me to work with this? Because, for example, when I was a teenager, I studied martial arts. And then the first thing that our teacher, the senpai, did was to tie our belts. He put some gloves, tied our belts, and said, start hitting each other. And you were like this. You couldn't, you know, go away. So you couldn't, you know, avoid being hit and hitting the other person. And he said, once you go through the experience and you realize, you know what, it's not a big deal. I got hit, I went home, and my mouth was kind of hurting, but it's not a big deal. Then he said, you can stand in front of the challenge without being afraid. You have gone through that. You have seen that it's not a big deal. You can be there with all your presence. So life is bringing us these experiences so that we begin to develop, and I wouldn't say even develop, to elicit, to bring, because this is all within us. So we begin to express that poise, that courage, that equanimity that is part of our nature. But if we are constantly running away, you know, this typical dream, we run away from a monster, and we run away until we decide to stop and face that, and then that disappears. That is a very important imagery that I know several people who had this kind of dream, because most things in life are a call to face it. Anything that is unknown is scary for us. When we face it, we start discovering, I can deal with this. Of course, these are general principles. Then there are specific situations where we may need a lot of work in one aspect of our lives because of our life history in previous lives, so it's not going to be instantaneous. But eventually, being faced once and again to a situation, eventually elicits the power to be beyond the situation. It may not happen in one single life. You may not notice it in one single life. In general, you know, there are a few things that we may not notice the results in one single life. In many other aspects, you will. But then in your next incarnation, that's something that is in the past. So if you start looking at life from that perspective, it's not this life only. It's my next incarnation, the future, the past. You know, we say, oh, but who knows, you know, in my next incarnation, who I will be, I won't remember anything. Well, we probably said the same in the previous incarnation, and we are right now, and we wish we had done this in the past. Today we would be enjoying a different kind of experiences. So we can say that, but in the future we will be there, just as we are here now, and we will have to deal with that then, if not now. So starting to look at life from the point of view of a far wider journey, where this incarnation is just one day in the days of the soul, then we can make very relative what is happening. We can, for example, we may be very scared of what is going on in the world right now. But study a little history, and 500 years ago, 300 years ago, the things that were happening, what the kings were doing, has nothing to do with the worst things that Trump or any other president do. You know, they would say, oh, I don't like you, come, cut the head. And that was how the state was run. Or the terrible things, oh, this woman, you know, is speaking out. Okay, there are these, you know, helmets with a thing for the tongue, with a kind of nail. Put the tongue there. Remember, we saw that.
Yeah.
And that was 200 years ago. So there is no equality, you know, the equality that we would like. Sure, we can work for that. But let us look at things from a wider perspective. We have gone a long way, and we will keep going a long way. We should, you know, fight, in quotation marks, in the most intelligent way to further what we think is right. But there is no need to be scared. When we get scared, we are not intelligent. We do things that just keep adding to the problem, whether globally or in our personal lives. So again, how do we elicit that courage? When we see things from the right perspective, wide enough. If we are lost in the tree and we cannot see the forest, then whatever is happening to this tree is my only reality. This tree may be dying, but the forest may be, you know, flourishing. But I only see what happens to this tree, and that is my reality. So the idea is that we are going to study these two books, and as you will see there, they all come from this wider perspective, and they will convey this wider perspective. And it is only as we understand the wider perspective that the spiritual practice may become far more effective. Because then, as I said, I sit to meditate, not to make of meditation another attachment to pleasure, but to discover who I really am. So we practice in our daily life to develop certain virtues, not to be proud of how virtuous I am and how better than you are and become self-righteous, but because I realize that this is just the way of expressing what I really am, what we all are. This is a question of we are trying to express what we are, not an accumulation of something and see who has more, you know, chips, virtue chips, or virtue, you know, account in the bank. So you see, we study about the power of thought, for example, as we are doing during the week, not because I want to use that power to bring more money or another husband or to get rid of the husband or whatever it is. Those are all little things. We use the power of thought to discover our true nature and to see how we can help the whole humanity to move forward. So you can grab a book, and the book may talk about power of thought, karma, reincarnation. You know, the two books talk about the same. But one is misinterpreting all this from the point of view of I am this little thing. And, you know, success is to use all the universal resources to satisfy the desires of this little thing. And the other one talks about the same subjects, but is presenting the subjects in a way that will allow us realize that we are the universal. That the, you know, this is a problem that is been there with humanity forever. Like there is a book, Shankaracharya, to quote him again, he said this, you know, you are the divine. This is very common in the New Age. We are all gods, or we are the divine. Now he would say, understand what this means. You are the divine. You know, if I say I am the divine, means I am not Pablo. Pablo is obviously not the divine. The divine is omnipresent. I can be only here or there. Even if I can astral project, I will be there and not there. The divine is, you know, omniscient. I have no idea what I should do. The divine. So when we are told you are the divine, it's not Pablo is the divine and have this sense of self-aggrandizement that is an illusion. It's you are not Pablo. You are the divine. Stop being a slave of the little needs that Pablo has. Again, that doesn't mean self-denial in the sense we have a body that has some needs, and we have to deal with the needs. You know, if we want to still express ourselves through the physical body, in the physical world, sure, we can take care of this. same emotionally and mentally. There are certain needs that are right to have a healthy personality. But that is not our problem. Our problem is that we focus on this and all our lives begin to be around what we are giving to the body. I remember in Argentina, my background is as a scientist. When I was in the laboratory, it was always the same, and it would make me so sad because the whole conversation during the week of most of my colleagues was about the big meal and drinking that they were going to have during the weekend. And then they would go the weekend and overeat and overdrink. And then the week would start. And again, beginning to plan, they were living for the body. You know, and I'm not judging them because I've done that many times. It's just that it was so striking, you know. And how many times we do that? We live for a little aspect of ourselves that is not the same as taking good care of the body. This is distorting the purpose of life here. So basically, the idea tonight is to present this view. Yes, techniques are important. One of the books to be studied is The Techniques of the Spiritual Life. But techniques are important only when there is intelligence there. I think this is why Krishnamurti was so much against techniques, because we tend to like things that are mechanical. We think, okay, just repeat this. Mantras are amazing if we do them in the right way. Just repeating the sound will put us in a state of self-hypnosis. And this is not something that I say or the theosophical literature. Patanjali, who is a Hindu sage that was the compiler or the one that generated the school of yoga, of meditation, he said, repeat a mantra and meditate on the meaning of the mantra. Don't repeat it just like how japa, repetition, is normally understood. You just repeat the mantra one after the other. That will quiet your mind. But what kind of wisdom brings that? That brings this nice feeling of being in a kind of, you know, slumber where there are no thoughts because you are kind of hypnotized, and that is so nice, and meditation is so nice, that I'm stressed out, let me go repeat the mantra, and then I feel good. It's okay, it's not absolutely useless, because it may release some stress, but if we are talking about solving the human problem, that is not going to solve it, it's just a band-aid. But if you work on a mantra, you meditate on the meaning of the mantra, you try to realize what the mantra is saying, the sound of the mantra, because it is connected to the state of consciousness that the mantra represents, and because you are pushing, trying to understand, to perceive the meaning of the mantra, then the mantra helps you realize the spiritual dimension, for example. But you have to do your work. If you just repeat it, it's not going to produce much. So this is the case with all techniques. Of course, when we start in spirituality, we may start just repeating a technique. That is fine. It's the first steps. But if we want to move on to get to something deeper, we have to start bringing our own intelligence. And that's what the theosophical teachings always propose. So before we close, I would like to have a little discussion, questions, comments. What to do will be studied in the meetings. So, you know, and I wouldn't have any either, you know, time to talk about that. But I think it's important how we approach it. That's why I'm presenting this. Any questions, comments, something you don't agree with? We can examine it. Yes.
Studying the chapters, how would you suggest we approach it?
I think that both authors do a good job of presenting this from that point of view. What I would say is that in the there is this joke that Joy Means, who was a great theosophical teacher, and she lived here. She used to say this joke, which sadly is quite accurate. She said, a theosophist dies and is going to heaven, and then he or she sees a sign. One says to heaven, and the other says to a lecture on heaven, and the philosophies go to the lecture. We tend to get enamored of the ideas. So what I would say is that it is very important to try to practice what we will study. All these studies are very practical. And it is fun to know about this, to be able to give a lecture about this, but all that is quite useless if we are not trying to actually live from that point of view. So maybe after each, you know, study group, we can do a little exercise for the week. Okay, we talked about this. Let us practice this during the week. And next week, we see we have something to talk about more than what we read in the book, you know, and see, because everything is clear. If the book is good, and these books are, or the speaker is good, everything seems clear, easy, straightforward. Well, life is always far messier than that. So if we really want to know, we have to try to do it. And then in trying to do it, we start seeing all the nuances and we learn how to actually apply this. Anything else? Any comments? Yeah, Italis.
Yes, I was hoping that you would explain a little bit more about what Buddhism is trying to do, in the sense that maybe I misunderstood the purpose of the teachings of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. But when he speaks about the truth of the truth of suffering, the source of suffering, and how to find the solution out of that. Mm-hmm. I never thought that the opposite of that or the result of that would be happiness. Mm-hmm. What I thought it would be wisdom, mm-hmm. which is what you
what I was saying. About.
So maybe if there's somebody in this room that is not that familiar with Buddhism, I hope I'm speaking because I hope if I'm correct mm-hmm. that they don't take home that the purpose of Buddhism is to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But to be wise and to realize, as Blavatsky said, in a nutshell, what theosophy is unselfishness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And if you read the Buddhist scriptures, that's the impression that you get, because I think that's what the Buddha said. But if you hear the Buddhist teachers here in the West, even the Dalai Lama, with all the respect that I have, there is a lot of emphasis on happiness, on being happy. And I have heard even, you know, Buddhists that you realize that they judge people, not in a judgmental way, but yes, this person is very wise. You always see this person happy, for example. That would never happen in theosophy. We wouldn't judge people in that way, even unconsciously. But I heard that in several occasions in Western Buddhism. So, no, I agree that to me it's a misunderstanding, but I didn't want to make a big deal of that. It was just an example.
Lisa?
Yeah, yeah. I just want to say, having read the Dalai Lama's book, The Art of Happiness, his definition of happiness is not at all what we would say in the West.
Exactly.
It's mainly about selflessness and compassion and inclusivity and wisdom, those qualities mm-hmm. that then will lead to...
Yeah, to the... Exactly, that...
Right.
And a happiness that lasts within pain and suffering.
Yeah, that's what I think is the problem, as I said, you know, what is happiness? You know, from the Buddhist point of view or theosophical point of view, happiness is not pleasure, which is what we normally think.
Okay, and he has
so,
a comment.
Yeah, it's exactly, you know, when people talk about, like, what's it called, life, and I'm like, it's happiness. I don't know, I've never associated happiness with pleasure. Mm-hmm. For me, it's on the contrary. Like, the more you get pleasure, the less happy you are.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I think maybe genuine happiness could be a good word.
Yeah,
it makes sense, but pleasure definitely, yeah.
Yeah. No, if we understand happiness in a different way, you know, it's a good word. The problem is how we receive this in the West, that we think happiness is feeling, you know, you see in the surveys that universities do. Are people happy or not? And people answer if they are happy or not, depending on the level of comfort and pleasure and things that they have. So now they are asking, do you think your life has a purpose? And they see that many people who say they are happy, they say
I don't feel that life has a purpose. I don't know what the meaning of life is. So now they are trying to reshape, you know, how they are evaluating this, because people normally think happiness is having pleasure, comfort, things.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Michelle Sender. I am part of the board here. So Pablo is my husband. I'm usually his wife, but tonight he's my husband. So, and all I could think of, sorry I grabbed your shoe, all I could think of was, well, he does the dishes and he takes out the trash, but that's not what you wanted to hear. So thank you. He gave a lot of talks today, and I kind of roped him into tonight to add to it, so I really do appreciate the work that he did. A couple things. Lodge members' dues are due to Rochelle, or please just don't hand me cash. Okay, because it goes in my pocket and I get to the store and I think, dang, I got money. And then I end up writing big checks to, so yes, that is, we are a membership-based organization, so we'd love to have you join us. There is a application out there, not necessarily just to join our lodge, but to join the wider organization of the Theosophical Society, and they have many things online. We are going to try to put this our Tuesday night talks online on our website, so that those of you, if you miss one, you can hear that. We do not charge for these talks, but we really appreciate any donations that you can give to us to keep these kind of things going. Anything else I missed?
Next week.
Thank you. Did you talk about the class going on? Okay, so we have a class going on 10 to 12 through Friday on thought power, and then Pablo will give a weekend meditation retreat on his book, Evolution of the Higher Consciousness. In the back of the book, there is some techniques, or, yeah, practical things that the meditations will be based on. So next week is October 1st. It is the first Tuesday of the month. So we have a meditation, a peace meditation that will start at 6, and then the lecture, which is optional, and then the lecture will start at 7. And our lecture will be Jerry Keefe. Is that how you pronounce his last name? Okay. Freedom, free will, and responsibility. What does it mean to be truly free? In what ways are we trapped and confined, but perhaps do not acknowledge it? Do we really have free will? Or is it an illusion, or is it the freedom to choose? What is the role of responsibility on the spiritual path? Are we our brother's keeper? These are questions you will pursue with a general discussion at the end of the meeting. So we hope that as many of you as can will join us. Please bring simple snacks, and we will enjoy them together after the meeting. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Oh.
Go to Massachusetts.